Welcome back to the sound plays of Traversity, Demons and Demigods, Book 2 of A Bridge of Doom. If you like what we provide, please rate, review, share, and follow on your favorite platform. Questions and compliments can be sent to our email.
After so many centuries, I've given up drinking blood. It's boring. Buy me a coffee instead. Yes, you want to do this.
This theater is not about profits, but the equipment and recording media do require funds. Though listening to these productions is free for you, providing them isn't free for me, as we are completely free of advertising. If you care to help, please buy the Count a Coffee for a dollar via the coffee.com website listed with the descriptions of each episode. All proceeds go to our production material needs. You can find updates on the production processes on the Coffee site. Special thanks go to our first Coffee Angel, Juanita Paz Chalacha. Except those wishing to remain anonymous, benefactors will be announced in the final credits. And thank you truly for listening.
Lockpins out!
With the game!
Step through the gateway and enter the universe of the Harkon Theater. This is episode 12.
This is book 2 of A Bridge of Doom by Kurt Paul Hotelling. Traversity, Demons and Demigods. The Journeys of an Enchanter.
Chapter 11. Troubled dreams of burning houses and dark sorcerers awoke Marie in the deep of the night. Around her, the hospital room was shrouded in darkness, with only a thin line of light from the hall gleaming beneath the door, and for an instant, Marie believed she was back in the hellhole of her memories. Then she caught the reassuring glow of the control pad with its nurse call button next to her pillow. Feeling overly warm, she rolled over onto her back and rustled a layer of covers off the bed. The after effects of her nightmare were still strong, and she debated calling for a nurse just for a little company. Deciding it would be childish, she exhaled forcefully in a vain attempt to blow back the oppressive night.
How long before dawn?
She had never found this world's yellow sun as comforting as the two suns of Fayek. She heard something in the room.
Is that someone breathing? The vague rattle of a dry throat?
Jerking her head toward the shaded window, she barely made out a person's silhouette in the chair.
Who's there?
A small sphere of yellow light faded into existence and floated in the air, casting its gentle luminescence on a suited man sitting in the chair beneath. The strangely familiar figure, wearing a large green suit jacket over a pale yellow shirt and brown pants, smiled warmly at her as he stroked a mudcat perched on his lap.
Hello, Marie. I hope I haven't disturbed you. I am happy you are well.
Unsure of his identity, having never seen Dr. Brinth in full light, Marie moved her hand for the nurse call button.
Who are you? Why are you here?
Do you not remember? I am Gaewon.
I forgot. Though of your world, these clothes are strange to you. Paul had the same problem initially. They are a result of my translation, though I can't say I find them any more comfortable than my tunic, breeches, and cloak.
Gaewon!
Pardon me, I didn't mean to frighten you.
They said you disappeared!
Relieved, she fell back into the pillow. Yes, I left my healing bed this morning. I was sure it was time to allow another to take my place there and benefit from their excellent services. He continued stroking his hand along the small cat's back, the creature arching its long spine and flicking its tail with pleasure. Also, I needed to find my ward mate, Glink. Still feeling a little disoriented from the lingering drug effects, Marie pressed the necessary controls to raise herself to a seated position, then wearily tugged the bed table over and poured herself some water, hoping it would settle her woozy head.
Dr. Hillary was right about my flu-like weakness.
I hope I am not intruding on your privacy. Downing most of the cupful, Marie then shook her head.
Not at all, Gaewon. I'm very happy to see you. I'm just jumping right now. Forgive me for snapping at you.
The cause was more than sufficient. Will you be healed soon?
Well, they say within a day or so, most of the drug should be out of my system if I keep drinking a lot. And I'm already getting strong enough to walk a good distance without feeling bad. What about you? I heard you were shot.
Yes. They tell me the healers, doctors, removed the bullet and gave me blood to replace what I had lost. Their skills at mending the body are indeed admirable, especially considering you and I are of another world. This struck Marie, and she mused silently about the interesting fact.
Just how much similarity is there?
Until the enchanter was mentioned this afternoon by Paul and Art, she had forgotten about her connection with Fayek, except through occasional dreams. Now the memories of home crashed into her recent perceptions of reality, and she wondered,
how have I been able to adapt so well? It's been a little over a year, or almost a full rayad, since I first awoke in this world.
She had been content to remain at Paul's side, but now Gaewon's presence kindled distant aches for clean air, fire-lit nights, and less confusion.
Will we ever go back?
Gaewon's smile faded, and he gazed somberly back at her. I don't know, truly. Appearing suddenly uncomfortable, he placed Glink on his shoulder, stood up, and paced around the room, his ball of light following him, remaining a hand's breadth above his head. Marie found some comfort in observing this bit of magic from her home, yet she also felt uneasy with the enchanter's restive behavior. Realization cut into her like a sword's blade.
Are you able to go back?
With a pained grimace, he stopped in his footsteps and turned to look at her. Somehow I knew you would understand. That is why I came here tonight. I feel the need for someone familiar with home.
You haven't answered my question.
Yes, yes, if I choose to take back Rothson's transfer key and manage to find a circle of standing stones, I am certainly able to return. He closed his eyes and regained composure quickly, then avoided her gaze as he glanced around the room and at the ceiling. Pardon me, please. I don't mean to be rude. It's just that... He stopped, licked his lips, then moved to the bedside. May I sit here?
Yes.
Marie pulled some of the sheet tighter around her. Once seated, the enchanter appeared more settled, and he looked directly at her. I
am afraid.
Afraid? Afraid? Of what?
He allowed Glink onto the floor. The pain. All that tortuous pain.
Your wound?
No, no. The pain of translation. The method I used, which at the time I thought paralleled Rothstein's, but did not, was very, very wrong.
Wrong? How?
She was both sympathetic and amazed. Her last memory of Fayek was of this man using his powers to send her and Paul to this world. And there had been no pain, no real awareness except that of blinding white light.
Perhaps the method is different for the one invoking the gateway themselves. I had been the recipient of Rossin's power, not the source.
The demand, the drain on my very being, my senses, my mind, was beyond description. Did something similar happen to you? Mystified, Marie shook her head.
No. It seemed interminable the first time, feeling all that cold, watching the world drop away, with only Bomalai beneath me, running as fast as he could. The second time was better, probably because it was familiar, and a relief to jump through the fairy circle and get away from the specters on our trail.
Gaewon stared thoughtfully beyond the walls as he pursed his lips. All that cold. And a fairy circle. Interesting. Then blinked and looked at his hands as he shook his head. My experience was completely different and terrifying. And somehow, I know I cannot survive such a journey again without breaking either my sanity or my body.
Do you fear death if you try to return?
No. I fear life. Life in a crippled body. Existence with a shattered mind, unable to enjoy and embrace my loved ones. And yet, I am sick of this world. I must go back. Touching her hand gently, his eyes swelled with tears, and he looked away again. I am afraid. With commiseration welling forth, Marie sought a reply or some consolation, but having little esoteric knowledge of magic or power, she had no words to offer. At a lack for anything else to do, she reached out and pulled him close, feeling love as if for a sibling. She hugged him tightly, understanding the conflict within his heart. For a long time, he remained nearly motionless. Then he reached tentative arms around her, felt her yield to his touch, and found something he needed. Her shoulder became wet from his tears. She found a feeling of kinship with this man whom she had known only for a day or two in another world, yet that fact did not alter her discovery. At the same time, their embrace allowed her to feel closer to Fayek than she had since first coming here, closer to the possibility of someday returning home.
Is there any other way?
Slowly he sat back up and wiped his eyes. I do not know. For a moment he stared at the wall again, then turned his gaze upon her. Thank you, Marie. She smiled warmly, remembering a night of eldritch terror and three specters bent on her death.
I understand what you're going through.
He lost his focus as he looked beyond the wall behind her. Fairy circles. Perhaps therein lies another way.
Is there?
I am not sure. A confident sparkle returned to his expression. It may come to me if it exists. I will ask for guidance from the spiritual masters. Anyway, Glink and I have kept you up too long. You should rest now. Her hand lingered on his as he stood up from the bed.
Where will you go?
The idea of a homesick and distraught Gaewon wandering the streets worried her greatly. Oh, not far, my lady. Fear not. I will be close by. My responsibility is for your safety. Go to sleep now. He leaned over and kissed her forehead. On impulse, Marie took his face in her hands and kissed him tenderly, then again intently, as if he was a touchstone, her key to returning home.
Perhaps he is.
Gawain responded in kind, as if he believed she just as significant for him. Reluctantly, she released him from her lips and her hands.
Thank you for everything you've done.
He looked into her eyes reflectively for a long moment. She thought he might reach out for more, then blinked as if realizing
what we are sharing.
He straightened, breathed deeply, glanced thoughtfully about the room, then turned, went to the chair, sat down, and smiled at her as the mudcat jumped back into his lap. Wanting to explore this secret moment, head off any confusion in her own heart, and possibly express mutual feelings,
Gawain, I...
But she could not find any words to serve. The next instant, his fear faded away and the room returned to darkness. As if by his command, Marie slid back into the sheets and went quickly to sleep, ensconced within the warmth of kindness and newfound affection, something she had not felt since losing her parents so many riads past. She had no more bad dreams that night. Chapter 12.
I really have no idea where he's gotten to.
Paul glared back at the cold expression on the representative's face.
He just left, that's all. Hell, after the way you people interrogate victims, I can't blame him.
He turned his eyes away and crossed his arms, no longer caring to have his body language appear cooperative.
You claim no knowledge, while at the same time you have stated this Mr. Gawain was your friend.
He winced an eye as he stared off into space.
What kind of name is Gawain, anyway? Surname or Christian?
He focused on Paul, who remained silent and still, then slid his steady gaze to Art, the only one still meeting his eyes.
Celtic? French? A variation on Gaylord? Or Galen? Or that Arthurian legend about Gawain and the Green Knight?
Security Chief McMorris offered.
I suppose that would depend on where he's from.
And that's the problem here. They have yet to tell me where he's from.
The university insurance representative remained controlled and judgmental as he passed his cool gaze over the three young men seated apprehensively in his office. The past hour's run of questions had finally come around full circle, and he was no further along than when he had started.
I don't think we can offer you any more help concerning the gentleman.
Bill's brown eyes wandered the room.
More help?
The representative wanted to shout.
You haven't been any help!
Well, if locating him is so important...
Locating him is crucial, because he is the missing link in this unfounded fabrication you call the truth.
Art shifted uncomfortably in his seat and touched a hand to his shoulder bandage. The stitches had been aching some today.
Why are you being so hard on us, Mr. Vinton?
First he's a friend, then he's a pen pal, supposedly. Oh no, that's just a misunderstanding among you. No letters were ever exchanged. You say he's not from this country, yet there is no visa, no passport registered in his name. He had no identification on him whatsoever when the ER checked his clothing. Just a fancy dagger, a bunch of pebbles, and a raw lump of quartz. If it weren't for the hospital records, I'd be willing to believe he didn't exist at all.
He could probably be a drifter, traveling from town to town. Such a person wouldn't be listed anywhere. An illegal alien. Heck, we got enough wetbacks picking berries and selling cheap, dirty sex in this county.
The stocky black man adjusted his utility belt and uncrossed his legs.
And that brings up the second matter.
Look!
Paul restrained himself from jumping out of his chair.
Gawain saved my life down there. It would have been me with the bullet holes had it not been for him.
That's why you're protecting him now, isn't it?
Paul closed up again and directed his attention to a spot on the carpet. Vinton aimed his scornful eye back at Art.
And you, Mr. Zadek? What was it you said bit you? Some large animal? A Rottweiler?
I suppose the doctors are the ones who suggested it might have been an attack dog.
Art avoided shrugging involuntarily, wishing his shoulder didn't hurt so much. He'd been offered painkillers after treatment, but declined, knowing from experience that they only gave him nightmares and did very little for the pain.
It was dark down there, sir.
Then where was this alleged animal when help arrived? Nothing was found in the wreckage except your friend, the drugged officer, and the remains of Dr. Brenth.
So you think I bit myself, then?
Vinton looked to Chief McMorris.
Mac, did they ever determine the cause of that collapse? A leaky gas pipe or something?
Well, the fire marshal determined the cause of the collapse as being an explosion of some kind, but there was no chemical residue found in the wreckage or permeated in the walls. Burn marks were found, but they couldn't find no trace of the catalyst, be it gas, chemical, a kid with matches, or a loud fart for that matter.
And what relationship did you have with that woman found in Dr. Brent's lab?
Paul blinked with confusion at Vinton, glanced with puzzlement at his two friends, then looked back with genuine shock.
Huh?
Bill removed his glasses and carefully polished them.
What are you talking about?
Vinton nodded to himself. That was supposed to have been a trick question, but...
If these boys were guilty of anything, including withholding crucial information, I don't see any evidence of it.
Vinton glanced at one of his printouts.
So, Paul, according to the Medical Center's police report, you admit being in Brent's lab. Investigators found evidence of a fight that apparently occurred in your dormitory room. You claim he attacked and drugged you in your dorm room and then dragged you up there. There wasn't a woman helping him?
He met Vinton's gaze squarely, armed with enough truth to appear honest.
No.
He wished he could state it was a succuba, but knew this would renew the investigation, mark them as withholding vital information, and make the whole situation worse, if not impossible.
So where the hell did she come from?
Got yourself a real Agatha Christie there, don't you?
Vinton fumed again as he stared angrily at his desk and the pile of paper strewn across it.
Damned right. More problems, more questions. God damn it!
Then struck the desktop with his fist.
The insurance people want definite answers. Fucking profit mongers. You think they might let loose some of that cash we've paid them all these years?
Chief McMorris nodded, then shook his head with a grimace of disgust.
Shouldn't your investigation be probing into Dr. Brenth and his purposes, not his victims?
Bill was clearly unruffled by Vinton's abusiveness.
We are. There's not very much except for a slight deficit of drugs from his inventory, occult paraphernalia, and a stash of arsenic, but no direct evidence of his involvement with any of this.
He drummed fingers on a stack of paper to his right and glared again at the three students, hiding the awkwardness he felt at bringing up that last fact. It was no doubt the missing Valium and Pentothal had been injected into Marie Ryder and Officer Logan, and Paul Bach's blood test revealed considerable amounts of arsenic, thereby confirming his claims of being poisoned.
So why am I being so hard on them?
Dr. Brent's initial call for assistance and claim regarding the three students' attack on his person was apparently unfounded in Logan's and Green's opinion. Subsequent investigations of Brent's lab office revealed a hypodermic crushed on the floor with traces of pentothal in the tube, partially discharged extinguishers near some minor fire damage in one corner of the room, and a gruesomely burned female corpse with a gun still clutched in its hand. Ballistics matched to that same gun the bullets removed from a wall in the lab and from Gawain's gut. Odder yet, the corpse was far more extensively burned than any portion of the room, as if it had somehow spontaneously combusted. And, Like the sub-basement, there was no evidence whatsoever of any accelerant used.
There were no stiffs missing from the morgue, nor were there any identifying marks on the body except for some unusual scars on its back, nor were there any missing person claims on file. Yet, just what the hell had been going on?
And though there was accord with the complaint from Brent concerning these three students, it was understandable for Arthur Zadek and William Leonard to attempt a rescue of their kidnapped and drugged friends. The State Bureau of Investigation and, due to Maximilian Brent's foreign national status, the Federal Bureau, had not been able to match a profile to the entire event. The best the experts could guess, Brent kidnapped, incarcerated, and drugged Marie Ryder for unspecific reasons, then, knowing Paul Bach was involved with her, attacked, subdued, and kidnapped him, again, for unspecific reasons of which he had not been forthcoming with either victim. The evidence of his involvement with occult or satanic worship offered only vague motives. He attempted to cover his tracks and incinerated a woman.
An accomplice gone rogue after helping him kidnap Marie Ryder in the first place.
Marie was the only one who could verify that a woman had been helping Brent.
But she was unable to identify her.
Gaywan, Leonard, and Zadek came to the lab to rescue Paul. The ensuing confrontation led to fire extinguishers being used by Leonard and Zadek.
Fingerprints on the extinguishers matched the two men.
Then Gaywan got shot by Brent, who then managed to escape. None of the men mention a woman accomplice.
Therefore, she must have been operating behind the scenes, then turned on Brent for undisclosed reasons when he returned to his lab, probably threatening him with his own gun.
Having access to various chemicals in his lab, it was conceivable that Brent overpowered her by incinerating her. As Marie's friends came to her rescue and were about to implicate Brent,
he then detonated a bomb of some sort in the sub-basement in an attempt to conceal more evidence, perhaps make it look as if Marie Ryder and the others were caught and killed in the explosion.
But, due to Bach's, Leonard's, Zadek's, and Gaywan's intervention, Brent became trapped in his own machinations. Though the doctor's guilt was easily proven in the poisonings and kidnappings, this explanation of his final hour was sketchy at best, barring any further evidence.
Which is clearly not forthcoming.
Regardless, nothing had been said about the dead female, either from these young men or by Brent to officers Logan and Green before he was killed.
And then there's this Mr. Gaywan, the gunshot victim who had simply vanished from the medical center despite being under 24-hour guard.
The office fell silent, the air thick with tension as Vinton chewed angrily on his pen again, wondering how this entire mess surrounding Brent and the mysterious Gaywan could be quickly wrapped up and put away. What made his part in this whole query so difficult were his specific orders to shield these three men and the girl from any possible criminal charges. Prosecuting Brent's victims would become a media circus and embarrassment for the university as a whole, especially on the heels of the local television news sensationalized coverage.
Fucking vultures!
Of the kidnappings and explosion and partial collapse of the Pizzo building's sub-basement. Some clear answers would have made his job a lot easier, especially concerning Gaywan, who had successfully dosed the arsenic victim with an admirable and unknown purgative, then put himself in the line of fire in the process of helping them find the kidnapped girl.
Strange how no one had noticed her missing for over 2 weeks, but then suspicions could have been waylaid with news of an overseas trip, lengthy home visit, sick relative, death of a parent, and so on. The unidentified, crisped corpse of a woman was a major player in that situation.
Maybe. Mr. Gaywan was a government agent investigating Dr. Brink. After all, they were both foreigners. Interpol officer. Confidential mission accomplished. Avoid entanglements with local law enforcement.
At his limit with frustration, and being a fan of the Jason Bourne character created by Robert Ludlum, Vinton stopped his fidgeting for a moment and seriously considered this possibility, his eyes shifting back and forth at nothing in particular.
Intrigue novels and such were almost always inspired by true stories. Perhaps this is one of those occasions. With a name like that, perhaps a code name, maybe he is French. Would the investigators dare to swallow that one? Hell, there isn't anything to disprove it as a workable explanation.
Bill sat up and tucked in his shirt.
Regardless of my friend's romantic ideas, your evidence concerning Dr. Brink would seem to be incriminating enough.
Vinton sat back with a pointed gaze at Mac.
Yes. I suppose that's the tack we'll have to take. But it sure would be nice if we could question Mr. Gaywan.
Art, Paul, and Bill found themselves breathing easier, the storm of interrogation apparently passing.
You got anything else for them, Mac?
Nah. Mac was unbothered by the whole procedure. Just be sure to register your guest with the campus police in future. We're short-handed, as usual, and we've got a lot of territory to eyeball with our three campuses, plus the connecting road, plus backing up the medical security branch. It helps to know who's invited and who's not.
He focused specifically on Art.
And thanks for hanging on to that crackhead girl trying to do a Peter Pan and Wendy act out the 10th floor of Sanford Dorm last year.
Art could only blink in surprise at the security chief, unaware that his intervention had been noticed, let alone remembered. Mac gave him a wink of confidence.
Yeah, my men were late because dispatch botched the location first time you called. Regardless, it's easier to discharge a living student from the school as opposed to a dead one. Far better to embarrass the parents than the school.
Art nodded quietly with a reluctant half-smile of acceptance.
All right.
Then exchanged a knowing glance with Bill.
All right, gentlemen.
Vinton tossed his mangled pin into the air and caught it.
You can go. The thumb screws are off. Thank you for your time.
As they stood from their chairs and shuffled quietly to the office door, Vinton gave Paul a sidelong look.
Is your girlfriend getting better?
Yes. Yes, sir. She's coming along fine.
Good, good.
Vinton felt suddenly uncomfortable with how he had been forced to grill the young men.
Damn the administrators anyway!
And glared at his desktop again as they exited. The heavy oak door clicked shut, heralding the end of the crucible.
Oh!
Paul leaned up on the wall as best as his cast would allow and shook his head.
What an ordeal. I've been to friendlier grudge matches than this.
We have ways of making you talk.
Please. I was waiting for his swastika to appear on the wall behind him next to his Gestapo coat.
Bill scratched his goatee thoughtfully.
Oh, don't be too hard on him, Paul. He's just the one who was appointed to do a thankless job.
Don't be too hard!
With a stare of disbelief at his friend, Paul pointed at the office door.
Were you awake in there? Or was that a cardboard cutout of you talking to him?
Well, when you consider the pressure he's under right now, you have to sympathize with his predicament.
Paul rubbed his hair.
I suppose you've got a point there.
Put your hair and nobody'll notice.
Art goose-stepped around his friends.
I send you all to the Russian front.
Not so loud, Art.
Paul couldn't help but agree with the satirical comment.
Hold it.
Art froze in mid-step and cupped a hand to his ear.
Is that Jimmy Olsen's watch? No! I'm hearing a pizza call my name from some location nearby. It's in trouble! I must go and rescue it. Anybody care to assist me?
Yeah, sure, Art. I could use a bite.
I'll catch up with you later, guys.
Feeling an itch, Paul unsuccessfully scratched at his arm through the plaster.
I want to check on Marie.
Okay, Paul. We'll see you around.
Art grabbed Bill and tugged him down the hallway.
Up, and away! Faster than a speeding mushroom, stronger than a pepperoni, able to leap thick crust in a single bound.
Paul grinned to himself, relishing in his friend's incorrigible humor and bottomless appetite for pizza, despite the verbal thrashing they had just endured. Then reasoned he probably wanted to see Melanie. He shifted his shirt back over his casted shoulder and headed for the medical center and his chosen, deciding to walk in order to stretch his stiff legs. Traversity, Demons and Demigods, Part 1. Sound plays of the second novel were written, recorded, directed, mastered, and produced by Kurt Paul Hotelling. Copyright 2024. Character voices for Episode 12 are performed by Geraldine Cummings, Kevin Norris, Matthew Zachariah Tunai, Arthur William Bloxham Jr., and H. The Great and Powerful. The Sextology of Novels are available through Amazon.com, are on Kindle Books, can be ordered at your favorite bookseller, or can be purchased directly from the author. Merely submit a request to our email. The wonderful music for this episode of the Harkin Theater was composed and performed by the ensembles of Evan McDonald, the delightful Mocha Music, Florian Sorrell of Tiny Music, High Street Music of London, and licensed by PremiumBeat.com. Public domain music performances are licensed under Lieber Creative Commons. Sound effects and original Foley provided by freesound.org, Mixkit of Victoria, Australia, Cusp Studios, and the BBC Library. This was recorded on location in the universe.